there, and welcome to the Unsightly American Soccer Podcast for the week of June 27, 2011. I'm your host, Hal Phillips. The Gold Cup has concluded, and the Mexicans, by virtue of their 4-2 victory, have laid claim to biannual honors as top dog in CONCACAF. This is our federation, of course, the agglomeration of North American, Central American, and Caribbean countries that holds a World Cup qualifying tournament every 4 years, and every 2 years conducts its own championship, the Gold Cup. It's nearly always held here in the U.S. We've got the stadia, the corporate backing, the ease of travel, etc. But Mexico's got the fans. Of the 100,000 who packed the Rose Bowl Saturday, June 25, for the Gold Cup final, 80,000 were in green. It's quite a scene. Tom Wadlington joins me to pick up the pieces. Stay tuned for part two of this UASP, wherein we talk to Spencer Robinson and Stephen Myers regarding matters Euro. But now, part one. Just put on the pants that I was wearing Saturday night when we watched the U.S.-Mexico game, and I found a $20 bill in my pocket, which is always nice.
Oh, that's a bonus, considering how much of a disappointment the game was.
It was a disappointment, and, you know, having a few days to think about it doesn't necessarily take the edge off of that disappointment. But there were a lot of good things that happened during this tournament and that game. We can get to those. But, you know, it has been a few days since the result was handed down. What sort of taste do you have left in your mouth?
It's terrible to lose a 2-0 lead in a cup final game, sort of like we lost the 2-0 lead to Brazil in the Confederations Cup, but I think Brazil was a much more talented team than Mexico. Although when the game opened up in the second half, certainly Mexico looked like they had all sorts of attacking talent with Gio dos Santos and Barrera and Guardado and a couple of other guys, Chicharito, of course. You know, they're pretty loaded in terms of attacking players, but I think on a different day, despite our defense being somewhat weakened and somewhat slow, especially with Steve Cherundolo going off injured, we would have been able to hold them to one or two goals instead of four.
What's interesting is that when the U.S. went ahead 2-0, and really the entire first half, they were totally outplayed, completely outplayed. And they were very lucky to have gone up 2-0. And they really were, frankly, to get into halftime tied 2-2. But in the second half, when they gave up two more goals, those were more disappointing in a way because we were really trading punches with the Mexicans. There were as many chances that we generated in that second half when the game opened up, as you say, as they created. I don't remember that from the Brazil match. I remember us going up 2-0 and really playing much better in the half where we were ahead 2-0. Than we did in the second half when we just laid down and ran out of gas and they pummeled us.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point.
So they were different games. The Brazilians are clearly a better side than Mexico, but, you know, Mexico continues to interest me just as a third party because they're very good. They totally hold the ball. They want to hold it. They do good things with it. They have a lot of attacking options. They clearly defend better than we do. Someone was saying Saturday night that, you know, you're guaranteed a good soccer-watching experience when Mexico plays because they can't contain themselves, especially against the U.S. They can't stop attacking. They want to beat us so bad. The idea of playing for a result against the U.S. is just not even an issue to them.
It is entertaining watching them, and I do think this new young generation of players that are in their early 20s for Mexico are possibly the best players to come out of Mexico in numbers ever. So it'll be interesting to see how they progress, but I think they're going to be that team that can play a very entertaining attacking match against Argentina or Brazil or any of the best teams in the world. But they're going to lose because their shape and their discipline and defense is not quite up to par with the top tier teams in the world.
I suppose that's true, but, you know, they're a side that's struggling for, you know, sort of legitimacy in that company in the same way that we are. And I don't know that the U.S. Is really more advanced in that sense, but I think it can be said that we've scored more major victories against more good teams in bigger tournaments than the Mexicans have.
Right, right.
In the last 10 years.
And I think the U.S. defenders have historically been very athletic and gritty and determined with less skill than the backs that Mexico would have. And you could see the nervousness of the U.S. defenders just trying to play the ball out of the back to their midfielders. It was poor. And I'm hoping that Kenny Chandler and Eric Lehigh and Clarence Goodson and some of these young defenders for the U.S. are going to improve and not be a liability when we go to Brazil in 2014.
I think that's a legitimate hope and pretty well-founded with Chandler. Looks like a player. Lehigh got schooled several times against Mexico, but this is a young guy who was playing on the big stage for the very first time and out of position. You know, when Chirindolo went down, he shifted over and, you know, to make room for their only real option. Well, that's not true. Bornstein came in. They could have brought in Spector, and I thought they should have. And I think Goodson has potential too, but the center of this defense is really worrisome. Tim Ream is not, you know, a world-class center back. Onyewu has shown himself not to be one when it counts, even though Sporting Lisbon just signed the guy for, you know, reasonable money. And, you know, who else? Bocanegra, is he 30 years old?
I think Bocanegra is pushing 34.
Yeah, he's not an option for 2014, and frankly, neither is Chirindolo.
No. Although Chirindolo is typically such a fit guy who's small and has good quickness and pace that he could actually pull it off. But he's on paper, he's too old. I don't think we may have a replacement in Timmy Chandler.
Well, that's true, but I don't think that it's reasonable to expect this guy is going to be in the side in 3 years when he'll be 36.
36 or 37, right?
Yeah, and this was a question that never got posed. I mean, he hurt his ankle. I mean, this must have been one hell of an ankle injury for him to opt out of the game. I mean, we've all had those, you know, you roll your ankle and you usually fine for the rest of the game. It's the next day that you're screwed. Yeah, and I can't believe he would have asked off the field unless he could barely move. But it wasn't mentioned in the broadcast, was it?
No, I don't think it was.
It was all of a sudden, it's like Bornstein's warming up and why? I mean, there was never any incident that showed how or when he got hurt. And I think it was key to the game. I mean, although it's got to be said that, you know, from the very first touch, the Mexicans got the ball, and we could barely get it back. I mean, the first 20 minutes of that game, basically the two times we did get it back, we scored. But those were the only two times. It was an extraordinary match.
Yeah, the second half, again, you pointed out we actually traded punches with them and could have scored a couple of goals easily. Dempsey had that brilliant left-footed strike that smacked the crossbar. And then Michael Bradley had much of the net open to shoot at and missed it.
Mm-hmm.
So we did create chances in the second half. It wasn't as lopsided a game as some would make it out to be.
No, and you know, this goes to the heart of the tactical, you know, issue when you play a team like the Mexicans, or you play any team that likes to play wide open. Do you open it up and take? Take that chance that you're going to give up scoring opportunities in trade for scoring opportunities of your own. For a long time, the U.S. didn't have reliable, you know, options going forward, so that, you know, if we were trading three chances for three chances, it was invariably a losing proposition for us. But,
right.
But there was some great, great combination play. The second goal that we scored was just beautiful. And, you know, even, you know, once that happens, you know, the other team has to respond. They're not going to go forward in the same way once they see
right.
that you pick them apart like that. So, you know, I liked we haven't even talked about Freddie Adu, but, you know, Agudelo, Altidore, and Adu up front, the three A's, it's an interesting little strike force taking place. They're all very young.
Clearly, Freddie Adu added so much to the team in the Gold Cup when he appeared, and they gave him a start against Mexico, and he was probably the best player on the field for the U.S., so he's a useful little player if you put him in the right spot and expect him to to dribble by a couple of people and pass. I think his passing and vision is pretty good, and he did well for himself and should be part of the team going forward.
You'd think. It was very interesting sort of to watch the last two games with him, and especially against Mexico, which was a quality opponent. He surprised me in that he was able to play with his back to the defender and really had just showed great touch, you know, was able to hold the ball up and shield it. And actually, he and Dempsey could have, arguably should have, drawn a few more fouls than were called. It was a very open match from that perspective, too. Hardly any whistles. And I think that was fair enough. I think it went both ways. But so that surprised me. The other thing that surprised me in not so impressive a way was he looked like he had a lot of defenders beaten, but didn't beat them. He had such a quick first step and got to the edge of them, but didn't seem confident in his ability to go by the guy. He sort of ran next to them and then curled it back. It was confounding because it looked like he had the defender beaten, going right, going left, didn't want to turn the jets on and actually go by the guy. Did you notice that?
Yeah, I think he did beat his man a couple of times, more often than not, he had a quick first step and kind of created separation and then didn't have the pace or quickness or something or confidence to continue on, and he got caught up with.
Yeah, and it was because he did all the hard work to create that separation, and Adu is not the fastest guy, but he is very quick. I mean, he should be able to step by those guys and step in, you know, once he's by him enough between the defender and the ball, and you know, then you've got all sorts of separation. But it was weird. He didn't seem to want to make that, and you know, maybe it is a confidence thing because I don't think it's a quickness thing. But this is to quibble with a great performance. And was it you or Dave Bautista I was talking to or trading emails or tweets with about it's a shame that you know, Donovan seems to take all the corner kicks.
Right.
And Adu is the perfect guy to be taking corner kicks because he's tiny and useless in the box in that respect. And, you know, Donovan is a guy you want floating on top of the box to gather up the detritus and put it back on goal because he shoots well.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think Freddie Adu has traditionally taken corner kicks for the under-20 team and other teams that didn't have Landon Donovan on them. Donovan seems to want to take all the corner kicks for the U.S., and they allow him to.
He took a nice free kick, too, Freddie did. Goalie guessed right and ended up making a pretty straightforward save. But that was over the wall and dipping down. It was on goal. And, you know, if he had crossed the keeper up and gone far side, it was a goal.
Just to put the Jonathan Bornstein thing to rest, finally. You know, Bob Bradley has persisted in picking Jonathan Bornstein again and again, even when he's had poor performances. But this one, he just looked so out of his element, and there were so many between him and Bocanegra and whoever the other central defender was. It was just it was apparent to everyone that he really shouldn't be out there, and you have to fault Bob Bradley for continuing to pick someone who hasn't proven they're playing left back at this level.
It's not even that you want to, that you're picking him for the squad and, you know, in a general way, because, you know, you need enough guys to be able to scrimmage full field. It's arguable that he is, you know, among the best eight defenders we've got, you know, or the best 4 to 6 outside backs we've got, or the best 2 or 3 outside left backs. You could argue that. But his choice to play Bornstein instead of Spector mystifies me.
Right.
Spector has his faults, but this guy is a reliable defender. He can play inside and outside. He's got size, and he's got some savvy. This guy has played in the Premiership for a long time. Bornstein is just like gasoline on a fire.
And you have to remember, Bornstein has gone to Tigres in Mexico, and he sat on the bench the whole season. So it's not as though he was playing in some lower league, like, I don't know, Sweden, mid-tier league in Sweden or Norway or somewhere, and he was consistently starting. He was sitting on the bench, so he's not an informed player at the moment.
No, it was pretty strange, and, you know, the question thing is another, you know, Bob Bradley sort of loyalty that I just don't understand.
So one of the knocks on Bob Bradley has always been his player selection. And there are a couple of people that he persists with, including Sasha Kljestan, who don't seem to be emerging as legitimate players. Robbie Rogers is another one. Mm-hmm. But I guess from a tactical perspective, you have to ask, is the U.S. going backwards in terms of our ability to play against teams that have a lot of flair and attacking players? Seems like if you look at the past 10 or 11 years, the U.S. had a 10-4-2 record against Mexico. And we consistently managed to figure out how to beat technically superior Mexican teams, often by luring them in, allowing them to attack, and then counterattacking because they leave so many gaps. They have so many people forward that they're typically not great defending. But the other day or other night, we just got outplayed and beaten tactically as well.
A couple things are going on here. You can't read too much into this last game in that regard, because I think that this is the best Mexican team I've ever seen from an attacking standpoint. They've always had some people of quality, but to be able to throw Guardado, who's outstanding, Dos Santos, and Chicharito on the field at the same time, I mean, they've never had anything like that. So they're far more explosive now than they've been. And if you go back to the last time we played Mexico in the Gold Cup, people will remember that was a pure B team that we threw out against for that entire tournament.
Right.
And they got beaten 5-0 in the final by Mexico. And it was actually a pretty good game for a little bit. And they got overwhelmed. And, you know, Mexico was better. And they had their first team, and we didn't. So I'm not prepared to throw in the towel and say that we're going backwards. I think that this generation of Mexican attackers is superior to anything that we've faced from Mexico. And I think that, you know, once we get a decent back line sorted, it will be a different matter. In front of that back line, I like what I see. I like the idea that a guy like Maurice Edu isn't even getting time. He's a good player. I mean, there's just no two ways about that. We have three holding midfielders now that are, you know, world-class, small W, small C. I'm not reluctant to put any of those guys on the field. There are people to play in front of them. And we have great outside midfielders. So I like the team, but until we figure out the next generation of our defenders, it's hard to feel like we're moving forward or back.
Clearly, Timmy Chandler is someone that's got to be at one of the outside back positions, I guess, until Steve Cherundolo decides to retire or is no longer in the national team mix. You know, should we try him at left back, where we've consistently had a problem finding someone that could handle that position at the international level?
I don't know. I think that the takeaway from this tournament is the future of the back four for the U.S. men's national team is completely wide open. Chandler has played, you know, a couple games for the U.S. He was very good, but that's all we've seen from the guy. Cherundolo is 33, so he's not really even in the mix for 2014. Lehigh has shown promise, but completely, you know, showed his, you know, he showed himself to be pretty callow against the Mexicans, although I think he was unfortunate. You know, Goodson is a nice player, but again, I mean, is he the answer? We don't know. Demerit is getting older. Onyewu has never been fast enough. Tim Ream is not up to the job. Spectre, you know, is got to be almost 30 years old now, and even in his prime wasn't the answer. I mean, it's all question marks back there. And I don't have enough of a handle on you know, who's coming up through the system, but some major, major things have to happen in the personnel of our defense before we can even think about competing, you know, in the next World Cup, because right now, I mean, there's nothing good to be said about it.
Yes, I completely agree with you. Absolutely.
I'm not necessarily worried about it. We're very early in the cycle for the World Cup, and there has been a pretty stalwart group there that in, you know, in a way stifles the development of young talent. You know, I've said it before. I'm really, it's a very unfortunate that Subotic chose to play for Serbia, because that would be a guy you could build around.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a top quality center back, who's only, 21 years old, 22?
Yeah.
And he's started for three seasons at Borussia Dortmund. They have a crowd of 80,000 week in, week out, and he's performed very well.
No, he's a world-class player. There were a couple of guys who played in England who were young American talents at that position. One was Frankie Simic. He's not really shown himself to be the kind of player that a premiership team wants. Is he still playing? He was the property of... I get them confused. There was a guy at Norwich.
Zach Whitbread is going to be in the Premier League next season with Norwich.
Well, that'll be very interesting, because if he shows himself to be capable, you know, why wouldn't he be getting a run in?
He's kind of a similar player from what I've seen to Greg Berhalter, who, you know, wasn't a great player, but when he was on his game, he was actually quite effective as a center back.
Well, I think if you're playing, in England in the top flight, and you're not completely hopeless, you've got a leg up on anybody else we have. Clarence Goodson is playing for Brøndby, not a bad club. Best club in Denmark. He'll probably get some good play. He's still very young. I like his build. He got shown to be. They were picking on him a little bit because, you know, Dos Santos ran past him a couple times. But shit, he ran past everybody.
Clarence Goodson is like 6'4", and you could just see the number of steps that little Dos Santos had going by him. He's way too quick.
I guess we can thank the Mexicans for showing us where we need to improve to not just beat them, but beat anybody of quality.
Right, and let's not forget that Fulham starts its Europa League campaign tomorrow at Craven Cottage against NSI from the Faroe Islands.
And NSI, what's the scouting report on NSI?
Well, NSI is comprised of part-time players, so they all have full-time jobs and they play for a small bit of change on the side. They have a teacher, they have a telephone salesman. I'm sure they have a couple of fishermen and whalers, and I think they're going to be absolutely overwhelmed, even against some of the reserve team players that Fulham has called up for the game tomorrow. I guess I was surprised to hear that Danny Murphy, the center midfielder and team captain, has been picked for this roster, and Andy Johnson. And several, I think probably Greta Hengelen, the center back, four or five regular starters are actually on the roster. It doesn't mean that they'll actually play, but they have been called up to dress for the game.
Hengelen just wants to play because he's probably got a couple of cousins in the Faroe Islands side.
Right, of course, being descendants of the Vikings and part of Denmark for hundreds of years.
Did you know that Norway was part of Denmark until 1905?
Yes, I did. I think they still have control over Greenland.
They do, and Greenland has got all this oil and wants to be independent, and the Danes are shitting themselves.
Yes, they need to keep Greenland.
Keep Greenland at all costs.
At all costs.
Fans that wanted to go see the return leg in the Faroe Islands have to connect through Copenhagen, huh?
That's correct, yeah. I guess the last I heard on airfares was that out of London, going through Copenhagen, you were looking at something like £600, which is approximately $950 or something, almost $1,000 to fly on a flight that should take about an hour and a half, and it's going to be a $1,000 round trip flight. When else are you going to go to the Faroe Islands? I mean, this place is one of the most remote places on the planet.
Well, yeah, it's a specious question. It's like, when else would you go to Svalbard or Spitsbergen? You know, the answer is you don't.
You never would.
No. So, why would you?
the next round has already been determined. So, barring any world-shattering upset by NSI of Brunovic, Fulham will be traveling to Belfast to play Crusaders of Belfast not only during the marching season, when the orange borders and the Ulster volunteer forces and all the radical Protestant people are out causing mayhem. But it appears this year the mayhem has actually started well before the marching season. So could be interesting, depending on who the fans of Crusaders are. So anyway, I've got to go. But
Tom, as always, thanks for the knowledge. We'll catch up to you soon.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.